Welcome to Twin Wisdoms, Episode 52, Signal Through the Blackout. Signal Through the Blackout. In a recent 90-minute conversation with Soban Yahyai for the Farsi Panorama podcast, the inaugural episode of a season titled Life in a Time of War, I tried to think aloud about the trilateral confrontation involving Iran, the United States and Israel, the predicament of the Iranian diaspora, and the cultural sediment from which a future Iran might be reassembled. What follows is a written distillation of that conversation, sharpened where the medium of speech compelled compression and folded into the longer arc of arguments I have been pursuing in the Twin Wisdoms. It was the 9th of Ordibehesht, and Tehran was still cold. Soban Yahyai opened our conversation by remarking on the unseasonable chill, hinting that the bitter winter of 1404, political, psychological, has not yet released its grip on the Iranian collective mind. He was calling from Tehran, from a new studio called Hamara, the previous one having been lost. I was in London. We were connected over Telegram, that most Iranian of workarounds, under conditions of dire internet scarcity. Iran remains under a sustained digital blockade, with the vast majority of the population denied reliable access to the open internet. The line faltered more than once. That the conversation happened at all is, in its modest way, a political act. It is one episode in a season explicitly framed around life in a time of war, and it accumulates by sitting alongside the recent dialogues Hossein Hamdieh has conducted with Hamid Dabashi and Esfandiar Batmangalij in the Borj series, conversations whose threads I have tried to take up elsewhere on these pages. My first proposition is structural. The confrontation between Iran, the United States and Israel is not, in its deepest stratum, a confrontation of interests. It is a confrontation of ignorances. Each side processes the other through media-generated caricatures shaped by security apparatuses and political establishments whose interests rarely coincide with the welfare of ordinary human beings. Israel I would describe, and the description is descriptive, not polemical, as a rogue actor whose disruptive interventions deepen regional hostilities. Its conduct is the late lingering claw of European colonialism, embedded after the older imperial structures collapsed. The United States, in turn, slid into the vacated colonial position. What was draped during the late 20th century in the language of international institutions has, since the dawn of the 21st, been brazenly cast aside. To miss this overarching frame is to guarantee that one's analysis will be shallow. I anticipate the predictable rejoinder: colonialism, imperialism. These are the tired vocabularies of a stale left. They are not. To register the realities of colonialism and orientalism is a mainstream academic position, not a fringe radicalism. The vocabulary is uncomfortable for a particular kind of Iranian audience because it implicates more than one party, and an audience trained to want a single villain finds multi-causal analysis unbearable. Yahyai pressed me on precisely this point. Chap Hargez Naf Ahmed, the left never understood, has acquired the status of folk wisdom. He noted fairly that many Iranians today recoil instinctively from academic critiques of capitalism and imperialism. Why? My answer was diagnostic, not denunciatory. What is being expressed in that slogan is not a coherent ideological position. It is a symptom. It is the desperation of a people squeezed between internal authoritarianism and external coercion, who have knocked on too many doors that refuse to open, and who now, in their rage, want the entire wall torn down. The reaction is human. It is also analytically empty. Pressed on what they mean by left, the slogan's adherents typically cannot say. The word has devolved into an abusive term, an insult aimed at anyone who dissents from the prevailing emergency mood. The exquisite irony is that the society these speakers idealize, with functioning healthcare, decent schools, a roof over every head, is precisely the social democratic arrangement the intellectual left has theorized for a century. They are cursing their own utopia. This is not unique to Iran, it is a structural feature of societies under prolonged stress. The economically marginalized American who voted for Donald Trump out of spite for a complacent establishment, the British voter who chose Brexit to scapegoat foreign labor for domestic decay, these are the same gestures, performed in different idioms. Iranians are not exhibiting a peculiar national pathology. They are reacting predictably to severe economic and political disenfranchisement. And what they want, beneath the slogans, is what every human population wants: a roof that does not leak, food for their children, a decent school, and a glimmer of hope. Here, the temptation is to speak of the Iranians abroad as a single body, to be condemned or defended in toto. I have refused this elsewhere on these pages, and I refused it again with Yahyae. There is no monolithic diaspora. There is a loud diaspora, and there is a silent one, and the two have very little to do with each other. The loud diaspora dominates platforms, media outlets, and placards. It is the diaspora of the slogan, "Death to the three corrupt," the mullah, the leftist, and the mujahid, which constructs a monolithic in-group and consigns everyone else to an enemy camp. It is the diaspora that, in certain quarters, celebrated the bombing of its own homeland. It is, in many cases, a diaspora bankrolled not by independent Iranian entrepreneurs, but by foreign state actors and intelligence services whose financial transparency is non-existent. The output of certain Persian language outlets, Iran International, Monoto, is what I would call, with full deliberation, intellectual filth, deliberately manufactured to produce a skewed and standardized polarization. By British legal standards, much of what they broadcast borders on incitement. But because the broadcasts are in Persian and invisible to the host society, no one prosecutes. The silent diaspora is larger, more variegated, and infinitely more interesting. It is the diaspora that endowed Ehsan Yarshater's Encyclopedia Iranica. But beside diaspora, we can still speak of the atmosphere and vision that sustained the Institute of Ismaili Studies Encyclopedia Islamica, that funded Jane Lewison's Golha Project, a meticulous archive of the entire classical Persian musical heritage. These are unflashy enterprises. They do not trend. Bombs cannot destroy the poetry of Hafez or the verse of Hushang Ebtehaj. Sanctions cannot reach a recording of Golha. The silent diaspora is the actual infrastructure of cultural continuity, the patient, unglamorous labor without which any future river has no bed. One cannot simultaneously claim the mantle of liberal modernity and rage against the academic critique of liberal modernity. To do so is to want, at once, the prestige of the West and exemption from its self-criticism. This is not a coherent intellectual posture. It is wounded pride dressed up as politics. Yahyae asked whether a plural, multi-ethnic, multi-confessional society like Iran can articulate a common national interest. My answer, yes, but only if we identify its foundation correctly. The foundation is not ideology, it is not religion, it is not ethnicity, it is not even language. It is humanism, the unglamorous insistence that the human being, any human being, precedes belief, mother tongue, gender, skin color, or place of birth. The human being is the axis and center of all values. Everything else is superstructure. I anchor this in the cultural geography of Iranshah, not as a nationalist slogan, but as a layered composite reality. Iranian culture is an irreducibly intertwined tapestry of pre-Islamic, Islamic, Shia, Sunni, Zoroastrian, Christian, Jewish, Baha, Kurdish, Turkic, Lor and Baloch threads, bound together by the unifying medium of the Persian language. The Shahnameh itself, contrary to the fantasy of a pure Persian text, was composed in the Islamic cultural milieu of the 4th Hijri century. Ferdowsi's Persian is not pre-Islamic nostalgia. It is a magnificent synthesis. Synthesis, not purity, is the signature of this civilization. Both the nativist purification project, which fantasizes about an Iran cleansed of its Arab or Islamic heritage, and the theocratic monopoly project, which insists on a uniform Twelver Shia identity, are spitting into the wind. Now to the harder proposition. Yahyae pressed me on the moral status of those diaspora actors who lobby foreign governments for intensified sanctions or direct military intervention. I did not equivocate. To petition foreign powers for war on one's own homeland is to manufacture consent for violence in the precise sense Herman and Chomsky gave to the phrase. The blood is on the hands of those who supplied the pretext for foreign action. Once the machinery was set in motion, the lobbyists discovered they could no longer stop it. Their agency, real in the pushing, evaporated at the moment of consequence. There is a historical parallel I drew in the conversation, and I want to restate it, because it captures the structural recurrence of the pattern. In the 13th century, the jurists and theologians of Ray and Qazvin wrote letters to the Mongol Khan inviting him to destroy the Ismaili state of Alamut. A Muslim community wrote to a non-Muslim conqueror asking him to annihilate a Muslim community that thought differently. The Mongol invasion that followed devastated all of Iran, not merely Alamut. The scholar's complicity did not diminish the Mongol crime, nor did the Mongol crime exonerate the scholars. History does not distribute guilt in clean portions. Everyone involved carried a share, and the civilization paid the price. The parallel to the present is exact. We have our Mongols, the nuclear-armed powers that bombed Iran for 50 days and failed to bring it to its knees. We have our incompetent Khwarazm Shah, the porcupine reflex of a domestic governance that treats both citizens and outside world as threats. And we have our scholars of Ray, the diaspora voices that supplied intellectual cover for external aggression. None of these actors cancels the guilt of the others. I want to end where I ended with Yahya'i, with a carefully hedged optimism. I believe, and I frame this as a conjecture, subject to falsification as any honest proposition must be, that Iran will reach a form of stability within 5 years, driven not by the will of any government, but by the irrepressible momentum of its people and its culture. The evidence is not statistical, it is civilizational. A culture that has absorbed Mongol invasions, Arab conquests, Turkic migrations, and two revolutions, and emerged each time with its literary and philosophical traditions intact, possesses a resilience that transcends any individual political arrangement. The German Chancellor expected the war to end in 3 days. It lasted 50, and Iran did not break. When the flights were grounded, diaspora Iranians purchased tickets to fly back, traveling overland through Turkey to reach their families. Not out of ideology, but out of an organic bond, no sanction or bombardment can sever. These are the droplets. The river forms when we defend the space between us against the forces, external and internal, that profit from its closure. Pablo Neruda wrote that one can cut all the flowers, but cannot prevent the coming of spring. Sayyed Hushang Ebtehaj said it differently. The red rose will bloom, whether you will it or not, though 100 autumns bring ruin. This is not sentimentality, it is the most hard-headed realism available to us, the recognition that life, culture, and human dignity are structural forces, not contingent ones, and that they will outlast every attempt to suppress them. The task is not to wait for the spring. The task is to become the patient, unglamorous labor through which spring builds itself. And while we are at it, to stop writing letters to the Khan. Thank you for listening to Twin Wisdoms. Until next time.